this lecturer said to me, the six words are going to change your mind, Tony. It's going to change your world. There's six words. And of course, at the time, me being that student and going straight to the head with this stuff, you know, I thought, oh, I'll come up with that solution. And I just couldn't come up with it. I couldn't come up with this thing. And I realized in that journey, when I was to do my thesis for my my BA in counseling psychotherapy, that I'd done a piece around the journey of an adoptee, you know, to counseling. That's what I'd done. And in that place, I realized that it was in that place that them six words were going to come to me. And amazingly, it was when I actually done the TED talk that I realized that that's the six words. And the six words were, share my story and set myself free.
Hello and you're very welcome to another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast with me, Shane Breslin. My guest on this episode of the show is Tony Dunn. Tony is a qualified psychotherapist and counsellor based in Dublin, Ireland. He works in his own private practice, Tony's Therapy and Counselling, and is a pre-accredited member of the IACP, the Irish Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy, and ACI, Addiction Counsellors Ireland. He also is a volunteer counsellor in an inner city clinic and works as a group facilitator in the Rutland Clinic on the aftercare programme. We go through Tony's incredible life story, his own journey to where he is today. He was adopted as a baby and he has spent his entire life dealing with the aftermath and the separation of adoption and its impact. He also speaks about how he drank alcoholically from his first drink as a teenager and the impact that more than two decades of alcohol abuse had on his life and his relationships. Tony talks compellingly about what his recovery journey looks like and has looked like over the last number of years. He talks about the phone call that he says saved his life and finding and facing up to the root of his alcohol addiction problems. Tony talks about the six words that he says changed his life and he believes can change everybody's life. Attempts he has made to trace and contact with his birth mother and how he feels for adoptees that closure is never really possible. He talks about his current practice in psychotherapy, what he's trying to do and what he's aiming to do with his practice and his work. And he gives us a couple of books that he feels are really valuable for anybody in the sphere of addiction or adoption. I really hope you enjoy this show. I think if you listen to Tony, I think you'll be struck by, like I was, his incredible honesty and passion for what he's doing and a level of gentleness and tenderness that I believe shines right through. I'm really excited to see where Tony goes in his career as a psychotherapist and counselor and doing this work that is, to my mind, among the most valuable work that anybody can do. Without further ado from me, it's on to this episode of the Life Well Lived podcast with Tony Dunn. Tony, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Shane, and I really appreciate the invitation as well to talk. Thank you.
Can I ask first, Tony, what are your earliest memories?
Yeah, that's really interesting, you know. So there's a couple of things comes to mind straight away, Shane, and that, you know, and I'm very aware at a very young age that I was different, you know. And when I say young age, you know, certainly before the second traumatic event happened in my life at 5 and 6 years of age. But I certainly knew before that I was different. Definitely was different, you know. There was something that didn't sit right with me, you know. And that's the only thing I can say on that, you know. But then I could say that I know myself in what I've done in my life to date around adoption, that if I could put the picture to people and just paint that picture as to what it really is like for an adoptee and at the early stages of a journey, you know. And I'd like to just bring your listeners just to a place where, you know, if they were to just consider that baby being in the birth mom's womb. And over the period of 9 months, you know, that baby realizes certain sounds, certain feelings inside, and maybe even sound, maybe even music that the mother likes as well, you know, that type of thing, you know. And then the baby is born into this world, strange world. And then what happens then at that stage is that the baby looks for them sounds, them feelings, and doesn't find them. You know, this is the earliest stage to that separation from your birth mother. And you may know, or people may know as well, that this is renowned to have been called that primal wound. And that primal wound is that place of separation. Separation from your birth mother, because we all know how it is a bond between the birth mother and the child. But when that's removed, that becomes that wound, that primal wound. For me, that's the journey. That's when the journey of the adoptee began. And I know myself that I was born in July, the end of July, in 71, 1971. So you could imagine the Ireland of that day, you know. I was born in Ballinasloe Hospital. I can't pronounce the name of the hospital, but I think it's called Portiuncula.
Portiuncula, yes.
Yeah. And I was removed from there, and I eventually was up in Stamullen in Dublin, there, County Dublin, in St. Clair's Hospital. It was a Sisters of Mercy hospital, it was at the time. And on the 13th of August, my parents picked me up. So in the space of the 30th of July to the 13th, I know them short period of days, they're days when I had significant separation. And again, I had separation within 13 days. And I know myself in the research I've done that they are significant traumas to have a child to have had. I was blessed. I am blessed with the parents I got that I have to this day. They have had a huge influence on my life, and I'm forever grateful for them. But we know that the Ireland that was lived in the 70s was a different Ireland than it is today. So yeah, I suppose that's my earliest thoughts on that. But then when I was 6 years of age, you know, I always say this because this was a major impact on me, and I know what this done in my life was had a major impact on me. I mean, just to put it into perspective, at this stage, I was the eldest of three adopted children, and my brother was 2 years younger than me. And then it was a sister who was, at that stage, would have been 5 years younger than me. Her name was Orla. And I remember so distinctly because when it was an evening, it was probably coming from winter to autumn, that kind of an evening, dark evening. And a knock came to the door. I remember the priest that came to the door as well, you know. His name was Father Egan. And he came, and my mother was there, and I was there, and my brother was there. And quickly, we were removed from the house because I didn't know at the time what was going on. But over the weekend, I was to learn there was a lot of sadness in the house and a lot of upset and grief that Orla was going to be taken away. And my dad was at work, but he was able to come home and plead with the priest not to take him, because at that time, they were able to come and just take the child away without notification. It was in that period of 8 months whereby the adoption order is granted that they can come and take. But the priest accepted it, that the Orla was stateless for the weekend. But I remember the grief that was in the house. I do remember the sadness. And I remember, because I was that type of child, I was an inquisitive child. And I wanted to ask questions, and I never got any answers. But I learned from that trauma alone that I went through so many things, not to ask questions, to be a good boy as best I can, because I feared that knock on the door was going to come from me, because it was never explained to me that at that stage that my adoption had been granted and they couldn't. But I always feared that. So I was living in an Ireland at the time where everybody was afraid to ask a question, particularly even an adopted child of 6 years of age.
Can I ask just to, sorry for jumping in, but to paint a clear picture, you were six. You said that Orla was 5 years younger. So Orla was a baby.
Yeah, it was a baby, yeah. Really. Under the age of one, yeah.
And you, this window of the before the adoption order is complete, where effectively it's almost like a foster situation, that the child before that adoption order is complete, that you mentioned that they can come and take it. Who's they?
At the time, it was a religious order. Father Egan was a priest from Mullingar. I understand. So he's Church of Irish Catholic Church. So he was coming to take the child away, take the child back.
So and at that point, the religious orders would have been taking care of children that had been put up for adoption.
Absolutely, yeah. It was very much run by the religious orders at the time, you know, state backed, but religious orders. Yeah, they would have been responsible for that.
And we know from later years, and we can get into this a little bit later perhaps, but we know from later years how difficult it was for the revelations that have come out even in the last, you know, 5-10 years for mothers who perhaps had a child born out of wedlock or for some other reason, and in some cases forcibly separated from the child.
In a lot of the cases, and what I've looked at, Shane, it would have been a case of, you know, that, like you said, out of wedlock, you know, or just families making decisions for young girls, you know, which was an awful place to be, where the birth mother has never had a say in these situations, you know. And obviously that was the change over years, going into the 80s and 90s, you know, that particular thing was the change whereby young girls were given support, you know, given financial support, or the families were supporting. But for a long time, it was just perceived as being outside of wedlock. It just was not going to happen. And you could imagine in a rural state, you know, where, you know, there was a lot of shame attached to that, you know, giving birth to a child, like, as well, you know, so. So
I've just realized something that I haven't thought of before is the word wedlock.
Yeah.
We never use it except in the context that we've just talked about it.
And
even the word wedlock seems almost violent, or certainly forceful. That's kind of maybe neither here nor there, but it does show a little bit, or shine a little bit of a light into the past and what situation and what kind of pressures and struggles and what normal life was like for
thankfully, Shane, and you're right, you're so right in relation to the word wedlock. I mean, it's an old word, but it has connotations around, you know, that locked away. You know, but thankfully that it's a word you don't, as you say, it's not used anymore. And there's a little bit more freedom to it now, you know, thankfully, you know, and openness as well, you know. So,
How did you feel different? In what way did you feel different as a young boy?
I think the big thing was not looking like other people, my identity, you know, because I know that, as a young child, I had this thing of, I used to go off and just sit and look at people, observe people. I'd just be sitting and staring. And it was that place of fantasizing about who I looked like, or, because I knew that in my own family, even though I would have been the eldest of my own immediate family, but I was also the eldest of, you know, cousins and all that kind of stuff and in families, but I couldn't see myself anywhere else. I really couldn't. Nowhere. So I always went out searching for that person, and I constantly fantasized about looking like a person, you know, because I used to hear, you know, cousins being referred to as being, oh, you look like your mother, you look like your father, you know, that kind of thing, you know, and then I used to laugh in later years that sometimes people used to say it just because, I don't know what it was, but they used to say I looked like my father, probably because I went on to wear glasses maybe at one stage, and I was wearing glasses. But other than that, I constantly seeked out that kind of who I looked like. Even down to fantasizing about looking like a person you'd see in television or something to that effect, you know, or someone you might see as a star figure or a footballer or something to that effect, you know. But it was that constant search. I found myself constantly searching. And even to this day, I see myself in coffee shops just observing people. That has never changed for me, you know. I like to sit outside and just look around and look at people passing and thinking about, well, what if they were my mother, father, brother, sister, whatever, or related to, you know, because this country is such a small country. You just never know. You never know who you could be sitting with and talking to, you know. And I always had this thing as well that I was always very open to talking to strangers. I was always a conversationist, you know. I'd always strung up a conversation to try and lead to something, you know. Thinking that someday maybe, and I dreamt about this, that someday maybe I will meet someone that I know and we'd have that conversation close to home, you know. So, as I say, I was to grow up as a child, and that particular time, as a, you know, after that second traumatic event, what really happened to me then, Shane, was that inquisitive child, as I said of itself, became that child that held everything back, was afraid to ask all them questions, feared asking them questions, because I didn't want to be rejected. I also know that when my parents at the time, when they used to go off and do, you know, maybe a night over with friends or something to that effect, I used to be terrified and have stomach pains and sickness and all that kind of stuff, because I felt that that was them rejecting me, moving away from me, which was never explained to me what was going on. But even to this day, there's times in my life that I often feel if someone who I miss, I feel that pain again, you know, them feelings that I miss someone. And it brings up them feelings that I had as a young child, like, you know. For long periods in my life, I tried to bury that kind of feelings. And, you know, as we talk about where that brought me to, how I buried my feelings in my life, you know. So, yeah, I was to go on and go to school. And school was a quite a difficult time for me, because I never really fitted in anywhere in school. You know, I was afraid of my life, of that person in black. And that was purely in that place of the trauma. Now, I was never abused in any way, by anybody. If anything, I had a very good childhood upbringing, per se, for anybody's circumstances. And there was a lot of people around me at the time probably were abused, but I certainly was never abused by the black cloth at all. But I feared them. I was terrified by them. And I went to Christian Brothers schools, but I never really settled in with there. I never really did. My reports always, I've looked up at my reports from school, they always said, if you paid more attention, you know, he'd be a better student. That's the way it always was, you know. His attention was very poor. And he has this rebellious thing, because although in Christian Brothers they played a lot of Gaelic football, I liked the ball, but I just, because they liked Gaelic football, I didn't like it. So I used to encourage myself to play soccer. And that was the rebellious part of me coming out. That was the way it was for me in that up to teenager years, you know.
And do you recall, when you look back at those school reports, do you recall the rebelliousness that you had, like the moment that you're rebellious, or do you recall the inattentiveness that you had, or that you were in, that is written that you had? Is that something that you recall?
Yeah, I was always that student in the class that would sit down the back, and, you know, as I said, I wore glasses, and sometimes I purposely wouldn't wear the glasses so I couldn't see the blackboard, you know, that kind of silly childishness things, you know. And I was always that, I suppose, that kid that got up to mischief in classes, you know, that kid that used to get the letters, you know, the letter straps, and, you know, used to get put into the corner or sent down to the headmaster, that type of thing, you know. I was always that rebellious child. I couldn't pinpoint, but I know throughout my years I was always in trouble, like, in school. I always seem to be in trouble.
And as you got older, what the rebellious streak that you had, what did that lead you into?
I suppose I was always found myself with some friends that, you know, in normal circumstances where I was living, I wouldn't be hanging around with type of thing. I was always them kids who were, you know, hanging around canals and lighting fires and that kind of stuff, you know. At the time, thankfully, there was quite an epidemic in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s in heroin, drugs and all that. I lived in a G-Cor. St. Michael's Estate was close by, which was, you know, was a haven for that drugs and all that kind of stuff, you know. So heroin was playing a big field and there was a lot of robbed cars going on. I would have went to school with a couple of the individuals as well. But I found myself, you know, being able to confront them, and I used to kind of put it up to them a few times. So I got a few hidings from them as well, a few beatings. So, you know, so that was another piece of rebellious thing. That was my anger coming out in different ways, you know, because I just wouldn't put up with that stuff, you know.
Was there ever any, you know, sliding doors moments where at that time, you know, when there may have been an opportunity for you to take a different path that would have ended up even, it would have ended up much worse for you? Were you ever tempted to take that rebellious nature and take it beyond that into something that was, you know, outright crime or the type of things that you were seeing around you?
I think, you know what, Shane, I think what saved me was I played soccer, because only for that, I think I certainly would have been. I played soccer with local football teams, and my father was kind of involved at soccer as well at the time, you know. But thankfully, no, Shane, I didn't. Thankfully, I didn't. I think the sport kept me on that. I was competitive. I was a very competitive kid. My brother was extremely good at sport, but although he was 2 years younger than me, he kind of excelled, very much excelled in sport, you know. So we were always putting it up to each other, you know, as far as sport was concerned. So that kind of kept me on that straight and narrow at the time, sport did, you know. Now, I observed a lot around me at the time, but thankfully I did not get involved in it, you know. And that's not saying I didn't get up to anything mischievously, but I certainly didn't get involved in stuff that would have brought me down a pathway to, you know, to my downfall, I suppose, you know, or crime, let's say, because it was on my doorstep. Crime was on the doorstep, very much so.
Tell me about your first drink. Can you remember it?
Yeah. I suppose where it came from, I was at at the time, you know, we would have been quite poor as far as, you know, and I would have started, I was employed at probably 13 years of age in a local pub. And I remember observing the men in the bar and looking at them having happiness in their face and being full of laughter and all that kind of stuff and the smiling on their face and fun and crack. And I didn't feel that I had any of that in my life at the time. You know, I just, as a child, I felt I was always a serious kid and I was kind of an angry, pent up kid that was about to explode on occasions, you know. I always felt I was jealous of others for some reason, always jealous of others. And, you know, I used to observe the men in the bar. And I remember taking my first drink in a pub, and I know I was probably about 15 years of age, and I remember having a couple of pints and getting on a bus and back up to Inchy Car from the city, you know. And I loved it. I loved the feeling that it gave me, and I loved how I was as a person then. I felt my friends enjoyed me, and I felt I was part of that place that I wanted to be, that I'd never been before. I felt I was part of that team that I wanted to be in, you know. And certainly I would have encircled myself with people who were drinking. And I found that feeling I got when I first took a drink, I tried to chase that feeling for long periods of my life after that. Never really got that feeling again, you know. That euphoric took away that fear, that anxiousness and anxiety that I had, you know. And yeah, but I know one thing's for sure, Shane, that when I took up a drink, my first drink, I didn't drink it socially. I drank it to get drunk from the very start. And because I had a job, in a pub. I had money. And so I drank consistently to get drunk. And because I was that type of child that did talk a lot, but was a very dishonest child, was a fantasy, dreaming child. Like, so I made up stories, let's say, you know, and that's what I done a lot. And maybe that was what I heard in pubs, was these stories that people used to tell. And I used to love listening to them stories, you know. And I found myself drinking on my own at a very young age as well. Because I was working in the bar trade, that's what I done when I left school, was I began to work in the bar trade. And I had them days off that were during the week when no one was off. And I found myself going off on my own and drinking in pubs and drinking with people who were a lot older than me. And that was the way it was to be for me. That was where I found that I had a bond with people. And I didn't find that I bonded with the people of my own age. I always found I bonded with people that were a lot older than me. Can never put my finger on why that was, but maybe it was a case of the stories, the lies you'd hear in a bar, you know, the telling the lies. And I just knew that that's what I was to do, tell the lies. And that's what I'd done for years, you know. And, you know, I was to work in a bar in where I lived in Itchycore, but then I was to move. It was suggested to me very early on in my career as a barman that maybe that career wasn't for me. And it was because of my drinking. It was literally because I drank on my breaks and drank on my day off. And that was what life became. So what that brought to me then was that love of sport that I had soon became no love at all, because I couldn't be competitive when I wanted to drink the way I was drinking. That was the life that I was to live then, from then on, you know. You know, I was to pick up at that stage as a teenager, I suppose, on relationships, you know, with women. And, you know, it was a case of, I was doing it for probably the wrong reasons as well. It was to have a relationship, like everybody is supposed to have a relationship, you know, rather than, but my view was that it was just to have someone in my life so that I could drink, you know, and that they could drink with me. And I was to have relationships with women that are a lot older than me as well. So that was really interesting as well, because they would have had experience in drinking and that kind of thing. You know, I mean, a lot older than me, not just a couple of years, 5 and 10 years older than me, you know. So they were experienced drinking at that stage, you know. So I was able to drink in their company. And that was, there was method in my madness in that front as well, you know. And I was also to drink with the people who were a lot older than me, the men folk were a lot older than me, because they could drink a lot more as well. So I became this 18, 19, 20-year-old who could drink a lot more than the folk, my own peers at the time. You know, I at that stage had made a decision as well to move away from Itchycore, because there was question marks apart from in the pubs that I was working in and drinking in around my drinking. So I began to, as soon as them question marks were asked of me, I began to move away from that situation. And that was around my drinking habits, you know. But I know one thing as well, Shane, and in all that place, relationships and friendships were very difficult for me, extremely difficult, because I had built up this thing within myself that, you know, at some stage they're going to run away from me or abandon me or reject me, you know. And they'll only do that because of who I am and what I am. And I was, at this stage, no one knew in my life that I was adopted, because it was never discussed. I never discussed it with anybody. It had never been really discussed in my family. It was always that elephant in the room. You know, we never openly discussed it. So even though it was something that I always wanted to know more about, I feared it because I was afraid to ask questions at that time, you know. So the knock-on effect of that as well was that I was constantly in that daydreamer, you know, dreaming about making up stories, you know, that constantly making up stories, you know, never telling the truth really, you know. Never being honest with people in relationships or in friendships. They never really knew me. You know, they never really knew Tony, you know. So
what impact did alcohol have on you?
it very much just numbed me for years, you know, took away all that pain that I had, all the pain, the deep pains that I had, the trauma, you know, then questions that I really wanted to know about where I was from, you know, why was I adopted? All them question marks, you know. I was afraid to go into the feelings that that brought up, because it was deep sadness, deep shame, deep guilt, you know, that's what constantly came up for me, you know. And I found myself that when I drank, that took away all them feelings, you know. So yeah, for long periods of my life, that I never faced my adoption. I never faced it, you know. But drink was my solution to that.
I remember there's not very many years between us, and I remember my first drink was at 14 years and 11 months in a pub also. And the Ireland of the mid 80s to early 90s, when both of us were kind of coming of age, I suppose, feels like it was, in my memory, it was an Ireland awash with alcohol. It was just everywhere I looked, there was alcohol. It was the alcohol everywhere, and people, like, it seemed normal at the time, but when I look back, it's absolutely like alcohol abuse that was happening. When did you realize that you had a problem with drink, with alcohol, and how long did it take you to do something about it?
Well, I mean, the first thing was that when I was 17 years of age, I was working, serving my time in the bar trade, and the bar manager was to suggest to me that the bar trade was not for me because of what my drinking habits were. You know, maybe it was somewhere else. And he gave me a solution at the time. He sent me to kind of a college thing and gave me a chance, you know. And, you know, I was to take that opportunity, I suppose. And over the next couple of years, I was to move away from the bar trade. But it didn't stop me drinking. It really didn't. Like, I know myself that I drank alcoholically straight away, absolutely straight away. You know, I know what drink gave me. It gave me a solution away from myself. And I know myself, that feeling I got from my first drink, I constantly chased that feeling again, and I never got it. And I got myself into many terrible states over the 20 years, 24 years that I drank. You know, I know myself that I could never face that I had a problem with drink. But like you say, Shane, I was living in an environment that it was okay to drink like that. It was okay to drink excessively, you know. And if someone was saying to me, you've had enough, I'd go somewhere else and have more. That's the way it was for me. And if I couldn't get it there, I'd go and go to the off license and take it home. That's the way it was. So, you know, it was getting me into trouble very, very early on, you know. And I know that I can certainly say that in relationships that I was in, that it was getting me into trouble, you know, with the way I was carrying on. Not coming home, you know, you'd only be seeing a girl for a while, and then suddenly I wouldn't be coming home overnight, you know, after moving in with them. That's the way it was, and that was okay for me. That, for as far as I was concerned, I was only drinking. That was the word I used to say. I'm only drinking. But that's the, as you say, that was the Ireland I lived in, and I felt that was good, and that was okay, and that was the right way, you know. But I knew on another level, I'd never seen that in my own home. I knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong. I was to, as far as, you know, as friendships and relationships was concerned, you know, I would have said that I was, people who showed an interest in me, you know, I was to sabotage them relationships.
In what way did you sabotage relationships with people who cared for you?
Well, I'd run away from them. I'd get away from them as soon as I could, you know, because they were getting too close to the pain, because they were getting to a place where, you know, that was that deep stuff inside me, that the word love was starting to come, you know, and I shied away from that. You know, I really did shy away from that because it was too painful for me, Shane. It was too painful for me to go to that place, you know, because it brought up too much of that fear of well, if they show love in me now, that I'll be rejected at some stage, because I will be rejected or abandoned by them. So rather than them doing that now, I'll do that to them. That's the way it was for me. Mm. And I wouldn't be too proud of that. That's quite a shameful thing to say it, by a person of my, from my stature now at the moment. But that was the realistic, and that's the real truth of where I was. And that's what drink does to you. That's what drink done to me, you know. It may have taken away feelings I had, but it also took away an awful lot of respect I had for others and for myself, you know. So
you've described that you're in recovery.
Yeah.
What does that journey look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it was them years were to go by, and eventually I was to get to a place where daily solution for me was to drink. That's the way it was. I didn't know any different. And I was to get to a place, well, where I wasn't only drinking, but I was also taking drugs as well, you know. And again, that was probably the same thing. It was the social thing that was being done at the time, you know. I had met this girl, and she was such a wonderful person she is. And she wasn't really a drinker. I was to have a couple of years with her where, you know, where I was drinking sometimes in the home, but I got her to a place where she drank an awful lot as well. But like that, I at this stage in my life, I'd moved into kind of sales, and I had worked as a functioning alcoholic in a role in sales for many years, and been quite successful on that front. But like that, there was a lot of things starting to catch up with me. My health was starting to really take its toll. I was extremely overweight, high blood pressure, all them ailments that drink brings along, you know. Not being fit at all, you know, not being able to keep up people walking even, and that's the way it was, you know. I was smoking excessively. So got to a place where, you know, I really knew myself. I still didn't see I had a problem with drink. I still didn't see that. My problem was much deeper than that. It was that sadness, that shame, that guilt, that's this is honesty, the denial for years and years and years. But I really felt that I didn't want to be here anymore, Shane. I didn't want to be in this earth anymore. And I made a conscious decision that I would take my own life. Thankfully, I didn't. I can't tell you the turning points, but the thing I could say was that I knew the person that was in my life at the time. She was a wonderful, wonderful person. And it was because of her, I think, that I didn't. Because I knew she was a wonderful person, and she did love me. But I didn't have to show that back to her, because I disrespected her. And she was a counsellor. And I'd lived with her for years, and I used to tell her that she's only counselling me. You know, I used to use verbal, it'd be a little bit stronger language than that, but anyway. But eventually I was to end up on a two-day bender on a particular year, coming to Christmas this particular year. And she was to say to me, you know, earlier that month in December, that please don't put me through another Christmas like you did the last few years. And of course, I'd done the usual. I promised her that I wouldn't do that. But it wasn't to be. After a couple of days, I was back to myself, the same thing again. And I was sustained that particular December up until 22nd of that year. And so it was 22nd of December. I was to end up back on my own bed. I had started a drinking session in Dublin. I ended up on my bed 2 days later in Newbridge in Kildare. And she wasn't in the bed. She was in a different room. And that's the way it was, unfortunately. And I knew then, I used this word for the first time in my life. I didn't know how to use this word. But I used the word that I asked her for help. And she never responded to me. But she did give me a phone number. And I made a phone call. I didn't know who I was ringing. I didn't know anything about this particular organization. But I made a phone call, and I made a call to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I made that call. And that call, I suppose at the time, I'd say saved my life. You know, because that was early in the morning. And my solution at the time, as I said, Shane, was to drink to solve it, you know. And I didn't drink for some reason that day. I don't know what it was. I didn't drink. And the man on the other end of the phone said to me, come and meet me this evening and we'll take you to a meeting. And I went to a meeting that night and I went into the meeting and I was shaking. I was shaking and I was shivering and I was in an awful state, you know. But I remember a man shook my hand that night and he said to me, you're welcome. And at that time, Shane, I wasn't welcome in my own home. I wasn't welcome in any pubs that I was drinking in. I wasn't welcome in my family home. You know, so to be told I was welcome was something new to me, you know. And I kind of embraced it, but I was very fearful. I was scared. I really was. And I sat down the back of the room. But the madness that I had got, that I was in that stage, that my state of mind that I was in, I thought that that girl that I was living with at the time, Niamh, that she had planted people in the room that were telling my story. Like, that's how mad I was. I was crazy. Like, that's how crazy I was. But all they were doing was just telling the story as it was, that I was alcoholic. But I really couldn't accept it. Couldn't accept it that my problem at the time was drink. You know, I really couldn't. But, you know, I was to kind of just, I was told that day, just keep coming back. And I kept coming back. And I spent a few weeks there going to their meetings. And I was listening to men and women talking about their stories, their experience, strength and hope. And that gave me, I suppose at some stage I had that acceptance that maybe drink is my problem. But I didn't know what I had to do. And I was to meet people. I was to get lucky to people I met. And all I needed to say was that I was an alcoholic. It's as simple as that. And when I used them words, there was certain freedom in that. There was a freedom in that that began my recovery. That was the foundation for the recovery. And, you know, I was to embrace that at that time was my solution was to go to attend AA meetings and, you know, to go on a program and, you know, to seek out that place where I knew my problem at the time was drink. But little did I know as the time went by that AA wasn't going to be my only solution, because that wasn't the root of my problem. You know, the root of my problem stemmed from very young age, very, very young age. And I needed to deal with that stuff. And that stuff that I couldn't deal with in an AA room, really couldn't. You know, at that stage in my life, I had had many, many, many visits to therapy. But again, when the therapist got close to my truths, I ran. I ran away from it. I ran away from that place, you know. And I do know that my first visit to therapy, I felt heard, I felt listened to. And but I was frightened because I knew that that was getting close to the bone for me. And I couldn't face that. But in that place of, you know, that recovery place where I was facing, you know, that place of feelings coming back, real feelings coming up, you know, I needed help. I wasn't going to get the help in AA. And I needed to see some people. I needed to start doing things as well. I needed to start filling voids as well. There was a lot of voids there that I'd been using a lot of my time drinking. And I, like, at that time I started to exercise again, you know. So I took up running, walking, cycling, you know, it was just swapping one with the other, nearly kind of addiction. But I took it up and it filled a void, it really filled a void for me. I felt that person, I felt someone new coming out. It was like I was coming out of myself again. It was like I was going back to that time before I drank again, you know. There was a fearness and there was a fear in that. But I felt that also, for the first time in my life, I felt part of something. I felt part of an organization like AA. And that gave me that bond that I needed to give me that growth that I needed to go on my own. It was like that stabilizer. I was on a bike with stabilizers. And at some stage, I needed to take the stabilizers off myself. And I was going to do that. And I was going to do that by myself. So for the first time in my life, I was going to do something for myself, as opposed to someone else coming in and helping me out, you know. But it took a while, you know. In that journey, I was also to really the real piece of this was that I was able to travel, and I used to sit on stools, bar stools, and say I travelled here and I travelled there, but I never did, Shane. If I ever went on holidays, I spent the time on holidays on a bar stool. But I remember after about a couple of months in sobriety, I remember being told that you should, you know, take yourself off away. You know, there's meetings everywhere in the world. And I go, no way. And I went down to Spain on my own. And I made contact with people before I went down, and I went to, I attended meetings down in Spain. That was, I suppose, the real start of my recovery, because now I knew I could do things on my own, and I had no fear about it, you know, I had no fear anymore. I had a fear of, you know, doing stuff on my own. I could actually do it now, you know. And still, I found myself that I always wanted to talk about, you know, that adoption piece of me, you know, that place of being that child that wanted to ask them questions. But I found in asking people about their recovery, I was beginning to hear that I could actually ask questions and not be rejected for asking them questions. It was okay to ask them questions. So that was a new place for me in recovery, that I could ask questions about what it was like for them when they came through their journey, and to hear the same them stories told from all over the world, you know. And so then I was to kind of start reading books, which was very difficult at the time, you know, and I started to kind of learn some languages like French and all that stuff. And I took a real interest in psychology at the time, you know, and I started to, learn some, you know, just attend some classes around psychology, you know, and I found myself really drawn to it, because that was behavior, why people are in a certain way, have a particular personality and all that stuff. I took a real interest in that stuff, you know. I embraced it and I began to learn. Now I struggled so much because, as I said, as a child, I wasn't very good in school. And like that, I had fears around, you know, studying as well. But then as I embraced that place of studying again, I found that I'm not bad at this. I'm good at this. You know, I can learn here. I was able to relate to people. I could tell the stories of the journey I'd been on. And that's what it was about, because I had had such a life story filled full of such, you know, so many emotions, so many different emotions, the sadnesses, the happinesses, all that stuff, you know, the bad stuff that went on, you know, the people I experienced, deaths and all that kind of stuff, you know, I seen all that. They were experiences I had, you know, but they were stuff that I was always able to, in my life, departmentalize. I could shut it down and start up in another. That's the way I always done it. And that's what I probably learned to do. But at some stage, all these different departments had to come up at some stage and come together to become Tony, you know. And it's only through studying and, you know, over the years now I've been studying and what I've become now and all the traveling I've done. I've traveled lots of parts of the world, you know, on my own. And gone into experiences. I traveled Africa on my own, you know, on many Christmases on my own in Africa, in game parks, and incredible self-knowledge and experiences as well. Really getting to know myself, and through knowing strangers, talking to strangers, and just sitting with them, and them telling me their stories, and I'm telling them their stories. That I experienced that it's okay to ask that question. It really is okay to ask them questions. You know, as I went on, Shane, I was able to, I remember a number of years ago being asked a question, and this lecturer said to me, there's six words that are going to change your mind, Tony. It's going to change your world. There's six words. And of course, at the time, me being that student and going straight to the head with this stuff, you know, I thought, oh, I'll come up with that solution. And I just couldn't come up with it. I couldn't come up with this thing. And I realized in that journey, when I was to do my thesis for my my BA in counseling psychotherapy, that I'd done a piece around the journey of an adoptee, you know, to counseling. That's what I'd done. And in that place, I realized that it was in that place that them six words were going to come to me. And amazingly, it was when I actually done the TED talk that I realized that's the six words. And the six words were, share my story and set myself free. And I really found that in that place that I always found difficult to talk about, that in sharing my story after that many years of damage, harm, all that stuff. But when I went into that place of that self-care therapy, and I realized that in sharing my story, that I was going to set myself free. And I've had so many people come to me and said, Tony, you know, that you've changed my world. You've changed my view on things. And it's only through sharing my story that I've set it free, you know. And I really believe that they're the six words that, for my life, has changed my world, has really changed my world, you know. And I embrace recovery now. I see myself as a person, you know, who has foundations, roots that have helped me in recovery through AA. But many other things, Shane, I've had to do. Many, many other things, you know. My life is, you know, pretty much, you know, it's that constant change. It's constant change. Constant looking for change, you know. And sitting with them feelings. And that question that you want to ask, ask it. It's okay to ask it. You've got to ask it. You know, I know I won't be rejected now, Shane. I know I won't be rejected, you know. Now, I know it takes a lot of courage to say that, ask them questions, but, you know, you won't be rejected for asking them questions. But as a young Tony, when he was 6 years of age, there was a lot of fear in him then. But it's different now. It really is different.
Something that I've talked about and mentioned quite a bit over the last couple of years is about conversation. And I believe that, well, first of all, just to acknowledge and thank you for your honesty. My point there is that honest conversation is one of the most powerful drugs, positive drugs, that we can ever take. And that's a two-way street. Conversation by its nature is dialogue. It's two-way. It's not a case that one person can be honest and the other person can be closed or dishonest or incomplete. But when you have two people in a room or in a public arena or wherever it is, and two people who are being honest, there's incredible power in that honesty that resonates and ripples outwards to everyone who witnesses it and to the rest of the world. So I'd just like to commend you for the honesty that you are showing and for the journey that you're on. Are you now alcohol free? Or...
Yeah, for many years now, Shane, for many years, yeah. Mm. I live a very good life now, Shane, you know, I really do. It doesn't come into my view at all nowadays, you know.
It took you time to get there.
Oh, I did, yeah, yeah. Not saying for one minute that it's been easy, but it certainly hasn't been easy. No, it hasn't been easy. Many, I would call them rocks I've had to climb over, you know. A couple of hills I had to climb over. But I've got over them, and it still happens, and maybe, you know, sometimes on a daily basis that you consider them things, you know, and particularly in where we're living in this period of history at the moment, we're living in at the moment, you know, and I feel for people who are in early recovery or in the height of addiction, you know, I really do. And I know I have, you know, it's a journey now that I feel I can give something back now. And I like to support and help as much as possible, you know, people who are in that place. You know?
And I want to finish with that. I have a couple more questions before.
Yeah, no problem, Shane.
Before I do. A couple of things that you mentioned in your TED talk. One of them was about I'll ask the two questions together, and you can take them whichever order you want. One of them was about everyone involved in an adoption has many losses. If you could kind of give a sense of the different losses, because it's more than just the birth loss. And the other thing that you mentioned was about the search for the true self, the search for your true self. And the way I've thought about that, and that kind of informs a lot of anything that I try to do with the podcast and some of the stuff that I've been writing is about this true self that we need to find. And something I'm toying with now, and I don't know if it's true, and I don't know that anything that I think about is true or write about is true. I have to explore it. But I sense now where I'm at is that there are multiple true selves, and we have to grasp onto one of them, and it will show us the rest. that I know that I am very different than I was 3 years ago. I'm a different person than I was 10 years ago. I assume and expect that in 3 years time or 5 years time or 10 years time, I'll be a different person again. And just feeling true to myself during all those changes is something that I'm kind of trying to do or trying to be. So those two are just comments or questions or kind of anything that you would have come back on around the different losses that an adoptee has, yeah. And also about the true selves that we have.
Well, obviously, I mean, just on the loss, there. I mean, you've got to remember that in the adoptee's triad, I call it the triangle. It's not just the adoptee. You know, there's the natural mother, natural birth mother. She's had a loss. You know, and as we said in the 70s, you know, I don't actually know myself. I do know the hinterland where my mother, my birth mother lives. But I have never met her. But that's still part of my journey. And I still see that as a piece of journey, my journey that will continue to be part of it and hasn't ended and it won't end. And I mean, I believe the journey is right to the grave on this. You know, it's right to the grave. That's what it is for
an adoptee. Do you want to meet your adoptive mother?
I'm in
your birth mother.
I've done many, I've really tried hard, Shane, to do it. You know, there's still, it's quite difficult. It's not easy in Ireland to trace. There's a lot of stumbling blocks. I mean, straight away, I don't have access to my actual birth certificate. You know, that's just part of the policy, the Irish law, you know, because of the particular, there's, you know, the birth mother's name is on the birth certificate. So there is that privacy that's required around that front. So that was the first channel I kind of wanted to go down, just to get my birth certificate. So I don't have a birth certificate. I don't have any idea of my, you know, my health credentials either. And I'm getting to an age where I need to consider them kind of things, you know. They tend to have an impact at this time, you know. So I'm still on that journey. I mean, you know, I've tried to make contact. And it's quite a sad story, really, to be honest with you. But I've been able to deal with that myself, you know, because what's happened there is that, you know, Tulsa social workers have taken it on and they made contact. And what was said to me was, Shane, quite honestly, was there was a voicemail left on the phone to say that I was not to make contact. And, you know, I had meant a few years to deal with that particular thing because that brought up a lot of anger in me and rejection again. But I was to continue to kind of hammer at the nail again. And I wrote a letter. And when I say I wrote it, I didn't use a computer. I wrote a letter. I handwrote a letter. And I was to produce the letter and bring it into Tulsa again to the social workers. And I was hoping that it was just a straightforward enough letter to be sent off and it'll be, you know, taken and whatever. I wasn't expecting anything back, really, you know. But they chose as a group that the letter wouldn't be sent. So I was also rejected on that front as well. So I felt a little bit let down. But that's not saying there's many channels, Shane, that I can still, you know, if I want to, I will. But I'm in a place now, a very good place for self that I've been able to deal with myself, you know. I've forgiven myself for that shame and guilt that I've carried for so long, you know. I found a self that I find real, can be honest with myself, can be honest like I am today with you. And that's my true self. That's Tony. That is who Tony is. And that's what I want to be as a person. And if I continue, that's the values I grow on, I've grown on. And if I can be that person today to you and to your listeners, that's all I want to be, you know. And happiness for me is the journey. Happiness for me is the journey, you know, it is. And it's not materialistic, this journey that I'm on. This journey is just about being real to people and being able to give something back now. And that's what I want to be, you know, and that's for me being real. Just to go back on that last piece as well, you know, that apart from my own loss about, you know, losing touch with a birth mother, you know, but you got to also consider the birth mother as well. That's a major loss for them, you know. I mean, could you imagine that that woman gives birth to a child and that child is taken away from her? I mean, that is traumatic. So that's a massive loss. I'm not a female, but the only way I can put it into perspective is that if a child was kidnapped from a mother, that's the way I look on that. That's horrendous pain for them. How could anybody ever forget that pain? So for me, that's a lot of pain and loss in there. And I'm very, very mindful of that. Very mindful of that. And I understand that every day. I understand what she's been through. And I also understand that, you know, what my own parents had to go through to have me in their life, you know. And I'm really, really so grateful to them. You know, they've been unbelievable, like, you know, the stuff that I put them through, you know. So there's loss in there as well. So I'd always paint that picture that I always feel that I have my parents and I have a ghost mother that's always there in the background. You know, she gave birth to me. You know, my father as well. So the ghost parents are there. It was always there. You know, you got to be mindful of these things as well, you know, when you're talking to people.
Do you have, on that point about the ghost mother and father that hover, are there, in, there is some sort of spiritual presence.
Yeah.
Do you get strength from that?
I don't know whether to call it strength. I don't know whether I would call that strength. No, I think the strength I have is myself, within myself. I don't know whether to call it strength with the, but I'd certainly say I'm a much stronger person because I can stand on my own two feet. Maybe they've given me that strength to do that. That's what
I guess. Maybe like in terms of the asking of the question, I'm not even sure how to frame it. But the sense of that spirit mother and spirit father, the mother and father that you don't know, can you or have you kind of given them characteristics in your head that have that have guided you in any way? Like even if it's a sense that you're creating some magic or some wizardry.
Yeah. I certainly fantasized about it, Shane. Certainly have, yeah. Absolutely. I've painted all sorts of pictures over the years, you know, as I said, about the type of people they are and all that kind of stuff, you know. But I've no real frame on that. You know, no real frame on that because I know myself from expectations, you know, I have to be careful with them expectations now, you know, I really have to be. The fantasy world was the past. I'm in the real world now and I like that world I'm in because I can be real about it and sincere about it. They're people, they're beings, they're male, they're female, you know.
Are you close to a position of closure on that or do you still have the desire and the sense that there's going to be some sort of opening?
You know what, Shane, I realize in life now as an adoptee that there's never really closure. There'll never be closure. I live with this situation and I'll be befriended. I've befriended it and I'm very, very comfortable with it. I like to talk about it now and I think that's the best place for me, you know, and I think the journey of an adoptee is a journey all the way. It's all the way through life because it'll always have an impact on me. It'll always impact on my life. So if I was to say that by meeting my parents that that's closure, I don't believe that's closure. I really don't think that's closure. I don't ever think that'll be closure. I think the journey of an adoptee is throughout life because it's had such an impact on you. Such an impact it has. I really wanted to paint that picture today that adoption is not just a journey to, you know, to meeting your parents again. It's not. It's a journey to life. That's what it is.
Mm. Yeah. I'm very grateful for your time. To wrap up, if we can, I know that the impact of what this has created in your life, and as you mentioned, that this lifelong shouldering of a burden or dealing with a situation and you have taken and you are creating something now in terms of your work and what you're building towards. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a practicing psychotherapist now, you know, and the journey to here has been, you know, a great self-exploration of myself, you know, and I embrace what I can do as a therapist now for people, particularly people who are in, you know, a place of loss of identity, struggling with loss in any way, you know, struggling with addiction, adoption, bereavement. That's the journey where I am at the moment. I'm actually moving on now. I'm hoping to submit a thesis for my master's now in July next year. And I've been looking at the whole relationship between addiction and mental illness, you know. And what I'm trying to focus on is that place of, you know, the link between adoption and addiction. But I'm very, very familiar that addiction has so much to do with mental health, so much to do with it, mental illness, you know. And even that word, using that mental illness, we need to change that framing as well, because there's so much encapsulated within that, you know. So hopefully in the coming few years, that wording will change, you know, to be allowed to maybe not be that country that we live in at the moment that's so driven by drink and alcohol and addiction, you know, whereby it's okay to have issues that we, you know, you can deal with them. We'll deal with them, you know. Because what you find at the moment is that people are dealing with their addictions, but in the end of the day, there's so much behind that addiction. There's so much behind it. And when we can get there, there's real recovery. There's a beautiful place for a person to be. And there's a life beyond our wildest dreams as well, when they can get to that place. And that's the place, the world that I'm working in at the moment. And I embrace it and I love it. And, you know, hopefully it's going to bring that brighter future as well for me, you know.
I'm sure it will. Tony, it's been wonderful talking to you. Before I finish up, where can people go to get in touch with you or to find out more about you? And also, are there any books or articles or things that you kind of sometimes point people towards, or different people who have been writing or speaking about this, about what you've been speaking about as well, that you look up to?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have two books that I wanted to suggest to you. And there's so much been written around adoption, you know, and but there's one book that I always find that tends to, from the very start, just put a real piece on adoption, where it is, you know. And it can be very hard reading as well for people in adoption. But I think it covers, because some books just focus on the adoptee. But this particular book actually focuses on the whole triad in adoption. Everybody that is implicated within adoption. And it's called Adoption Healing. And it's by Joe Soll, Joe, S-O-L-L. And A Path to Recovery is what it's called, you know. And I find that a fantastic book for people to read, you know. And the other book I find that there's a guy called Garber Mate, who is a physician, psychologist, speaker, world-renowned speaker. And he has many TED Talks and wrote many books. But one of his particular books that I particularly like, because it actually deals with that whole thing of addiction and attachment, you know, and it's called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And I'd recommend that reading, you know. And both books are not books that have to be read from start to finish. They're just pick them up, read a chapter, reflect, and get something out of it, you know. And a way you can contact me, I mean, I have a private practice and my website is it's Tony's Therapy and Counseling. So it's TTANDC.ie. And, you know, then my TED Talk as well, the Journey of an Adoptee. It's on TEDx. And, yeah, that's really all. I really appreciate, Shane, given me this opportunity to talk, you know, and I'm really glad I done this, you know, I really am glad. And it's been quite therapeutic for me as well to talk about this as well, you know, because it brought up a bit as well, you know, so I really, really appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Tony. It was, I confess, and we're still recording and this is going to go in, but I confess that I didn't know where this would go, and I wasn't sure I could do a good job of talking to you about it, because it's so outside the realm of my own experience. And I hope that I've just been able to stay quiet and let you speak about your story, and I'm very, very grateful that you did so. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shane.
Shane here, really briefly before I let you go. Thank you so much, first of all, for listening all the way to the end of the show. If this show resonated with you, I'd be so grateful if you could do one of two things. Number one, you can leave a review on whatever system it was that you listened to the show. If that was on Apple Podcasts, just go to Apple Podcasts, find this show, The Life Well Lived Podcast, and leave a review. That helps to get this show to more listeners. And if you liked or valued this show, I'd be so grateful if you could do that. The second thing you can do is share this episode with any of your friends, contacts, family, anybody that you think could benefit from the topics we discussed in this show. The easiest way to do that is to open up your phone, if you're listening on your phone, and take a screenshot of this episode and just post it on whatever social network is most comfortable for you, or wherever you spend most time. You can also go to my website, which is shanebreslin.com/podcast, and you will find the direct link to this episode there, and you can share it there on social media or email or wherever you like to share. So that's all from me for this episode of the Life Well Lived podcast. I'm again very grateful that you have downloaded, listened, and I think you'll agree that Tony and his work is incredibly important for all the challenges that so many people face in the world right now. So thank you again, and I'll see you again back here soon. Bye-bye.